My name is Steve Treichler. I'm on the pastoral staff here at Hope, and I hope you had a Merry Christmas. We are doing a series called Preaching Around the Advent Wreath, four-week series, and we're in week three. And so if you're Eastern Orthodox, we're going to land on Christmas at the exact same time as when the Eastern Orthodox Christmas is, roughly, or I don't exactly know when it is, January or something. We're a little bit behind. But actually, as I've been thinking about this, I've been kind of blessed by that, because I think sometimes you can't even think about Christmas because of all the, I don't want to say bad things, but just kind of, what's the right, the word I want to say is trappings, but maybe that's a bad thing. I mean, it's the extra stuff that comes with Christmas, all the baking, all the gift giving, all the people to see and all that. And you, in the midst of all of that, and already a too busy lifestyle, you can't just really stop and just think about it. So that's a nice way of excusing that I'm really late in doing this, but that's all right. We're talking about the four candles. The first candle we talked about was hope. Second candle represents love. And the third candle represents peace. And I learned something about myself yesterday. I must not be a very peaceful person, because I had more writer's block yesterday and working on this than I've had in any message. So I thought, man, when did I last preach on peace? I've never preached on peace. So there you go. So here you go. You're getting an original. Nothing. The third candle represents peace. When you think of peace, though, the first thing you think of is the opposite of peace. You think of war, right? Think of something like this. You think of the lack of war, or the lack of some type of conflict happening in the world. Then you think we're in a time of peace. A man by the name of Chris Hedges has written a book called What Every Person Should Know About War. And he starts off in chapter 1, and he just goes through a list of questions, and I want to just list a couple of these because I think it's really helpful. He says, what is a war? What's the definition of a war? The way that United Nations and Chris Hedges and others define a war is simply this. War is defined as an act of conflict that has claimed more than 1,000 lives. Okay? So what you experienced with your family last Thursday during Christmas meal was not a war. It felt like it, well, I don't know, unless it claimed 1,000 lives, but I doubt it. Okay? Second, has the world, this is a fascinating question, has the world ever, as an entire globe, been at peace? Now, I actually was shocked by this answer. Yes, it has. Yes, it has. It says, in the past 3,400 years, as long as they've been recording history this way, 8% of the time, 268 of them, there has been times of global peace. Now, not near my lifetime, but there has been different periods of peace. How many people have died in wars? At least, from their recollection, 108 million people. That'd be a third of all the people, roughly, who live in the United States right now have been killed in a war. Estimates for the total of killed in wars throughout all of human history, that was in the 20th century, and all of human history was somewhere between, this is a wide range, obviously, 150 million to a billion. So give or take a couple hundred million, right? I mean, so a lot of people have been killed. How many wars are taking place right now? At the beginning of this book was written in 2003, there were 30 wars going on around the world. These included conflicts in Afghanistan, Algeria, and I won't read all the other countries. Now, that's 2003. I did a little research, and this map right here, this grid right here, shows all of the conflicts that are happening right now. If I count them right, I still come up with 30 of conflicts that are still happening right now. You see, some have been going on, it's maybe small print, but upper left-hand corner from 1948. You can see the second one down there is the Israeli-Pakistani conflict. That has been going on, all of those, up until present. We have a new conflict started this year, the first Eritrean Civil War. So there's all kinds of things taking place. And if you look at this map, next picture, you can see where those conflicts are. And you can see that it's no, except for like two of them, they're all in what missiologists call the 1040 window, which is if you take a window between the equators, or excuse me, between the tropics, and you go 10 and 40, there's a slant in there, and it's the most unreached people in the world for Christianity, and it's also where there's more wars than anyone else. There was a man, here's his picture. His name was Robert Oppenheimer. Anybody know him? Any physicists here? Yeah, there we go. Oppenheimer, what did he do? What was Oppenheimer's deal? Yep, he's the guy, Manhattan Project. He was in charge of making the first atom bomb. In 1949 or after that, he had some very, very interesting politics. He's an interesting guy to read about, real interesting. He married a woman who was a known party member of the Communist Party. So, I mean, this is really interesting. I don't know if they knew that when they let him have the keys to the bomb here, but he and others created this atom bomb. And he was also a man of peace. They asked him a question in a hearing, they had a congressional hearing, and they started realizing that we have taken this guy, we have taken this thing out of Pandora's box, this atom bomb. We've now created a world where there's something where we could blow each other completely off the face of it. So in these congressional hearings, they're asking him, is there any possible defense for the bomb? And he says, of course there is. And there's his answer. Peace. It's the only answer to a world where you can push a button and blow up an entire continent. And this was when he introduced the first bomb, not the more powerful bombs that we have now. How do you get peace? How do you get peace in the world? Now, you know me from, if those of you who do know me, from this pulpit or from this music stand, I don't preach politics. I don't. I don't think that's the proper place here. But I am a little bit here this morning. How do you get world peace? How do you do that? And I'm going to make a presupposition here that you can chew over whether or not you agree with this presupposition. My presupposition is this. A nation of peace or a world of peace is filled by people of peace and led by leaders of peace. If you don't have that, you cannot have peace. Because if my default, when you do something against me, is to attack you, or if my default is to be a person who wants more, to expand my boundaries, or to take more, then I will by definition be not a person of peace. I will be a person of aggression. I will be a person of attack. Now, so what I want to talk about this morning is, how do you become a person of peace? That's where I want to go with. And I want to look at a guy. I want to look at a guy whose name is Joseph. And I am missing page 4. That's all right. I can do it here. How do you become a person of peace? There's a guy by the name of Joseph. And he had in the Bible, and he was a person who I think I want to introduce you this morning so you can see who he was. And I want to highlight his life so you understand that some of the things that took place in his life, if you emulate them, you can become more like candle number 3, a person of peace. His beginnings, though, were pretty dysfunctional. Look, his family looks something like this. his start, in the world would I do with that? Anyway, his start was he had a father named Jacob. Jacob, in the Bible, that word means deceiver. Nice. Got a dad. His name's Deceiver. Beautiful. Jacob gets this, he's the second born with this other guy named Esau, and he deceives his way into getting the blessing of the firstborn. If you read the whole account, it's very deceptive. And his mother helps him quite a bit to get this. He goes off then, and he wants to make it on his own. He finds a beautiful woman. He wants to marry her. This man by the name of Laban, the woman's father, says, you got to work for me for 7 years. The woman's name is Rachel. Says, all right, I'll work for you for 7 years. He works for her 7 years. Comes the wedding day. She comes down. They get married. And they do the honeymoon thing. Anyway, and they wake up in the morning. And he realizes it's not the woman he wanted to marry. Now, that's interesting all in itself, okay? I mean, that just, you think somewhere in one of the pictures or something, you'd notice. This is not the wife, but this is the sister, Leah. So he marries Leah, and he goes back to Laban and says, what up? I asked for the other one, you gave me this one. He says, well, that's the older daughter. She has to get married first. Work for me for another 7 years, and you'll get the other one. Laban's a shrewd businessman, so he does that. He works for him for another 7 years. He gets Rachel, now as his wife. He's a two-for-one deal. He's got two wives. Now, from that comes some interesting thing. Leah starts having children. Rachel is barren. Rachel can't have children. And as you read in this next passage, it says, when Rachel saw that she was not bearing Jacob any children, she became jealous of her sister. She got this cat fight going on. You know, I love my wife, but can you imagine having two of them? Or if you're married to a husband, two, just two of them. I mean, that's, whoa. But now you got, and they're fighting. They're fighting because the one is having children, the other one can't. So she said to Jacob, give me a child or I'll die. Jacob, being the pure, counseling, warm, affectionate guy, says, am I in the place of God who's kept you from having children? That's probably not the most affectionate thing he could possibly say at that moment when she's struggling. Then, she has an idea. Instead of Leah having children, I will bring my servants to my husband. He will lay with them, and then they will have children. And somehow this is better. And so she has two different servant girls that she gives to Jacob. They have four more children this way. I mean, can you imagine family gatherings now? This is already whacked completely. Finally, though, Rachel starts having children. The God remembered Rachel. He listened to her and opened her womb. She became pregnant, gave birth to a son, and said, God has taken away my disgrace. She named him, here it is, Joseph. And his name means, may the Lord add to me another son. The Lord has added to me is the name of that son. So she finally has it. She ends up having another son named Benjamin. So Rachel has two children, and Leah has a bunch, and these servants have a bunch, and if you add them all up, you get 12. And here you go, and you guys think it was hard to go back to your house for Thanksgiving and Christmas. This is crazy. This is a crazy family. Now, let's pick it up. What happens here? You start to go to the next one. If you read through the passage, and I'm taking you all the way from Genesis 30 to Genesis 50 this morning, so we're just going to skip through little things. I want to show you the character of this man by the name of Joseph. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than any of the other sons because he had been born to him in his old age, and he had made a richly ornamented robe for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of the other ones, they said, no big deal. No, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. Can you imagine? If you're in a family, and some of you can, because you know that one of the kids gets treated better. And it's not even, he makes this big robe for him, and he only makes one robe. I mean, you got to make 12 robes, Jacob. You got to make 12, you got to give them all. But he doesn't, he makes one. They hated him, could not speak a kind word to him. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. So the younger one has his dream, and he tells his brothers about it. The dream goes like this. Listen to the dream I had. We were all binding sheaves of corn out in the field, and when suddenly my sheaf rose, stood upright, while your sheaves gathered round mine and bowed down to it. Well, that'll go well with brothers. Hey, no big deal. I can just humble myself before you. No big deal. His brother said to him, do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us? And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Note, if you're the youngest in the family, you get a dream, keep it to yourself. Now, it goes on, though. Then he had another dream. He told it to his brothers. He said, listen, I had another dream, and this time the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. Oh, my gosh. When he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you? His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Okay, now, you can imagine, you can see where this is going. When they get an opportunity, they're gonna do something to this brother. And here's what it is. Joseph is going to travel, and he's gonna go and view his brothers who are out in the field. All right? His brothers see him, it says in verse 18 of chapter 37. When they see him in the distance, before they reach him, so you can see him, he's a dot in the distance and he's coming, and they start to plot. Here comes that dreamer. Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams. When Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. There's always one squealer when you have 10 other brothers. So, let's not take his life, he said. Don't shed any blood. throw him into this cistern here in the desert, but don't lay a hand on him. Now, he's a squealer, but he's not that good of a squealer. He's still going to throw him in a well. Reuben said this to rescue him from them and to take him back to his father. So when Joseph came to his brother, they stripped him of his robe, the richly ornamented robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. Now the cistern was empty and there was no water in it. As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, being the businessman that he was, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him, to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he's our brother, our own flesh and blood." I mean, certainly we want... God. And his brothers agreed. They make a little more profit here. That's a good thing. See, now, think of yourself as Joseph. What's going on within you? Granted, you don't have the best judgment already, but you've just been hacked on by 11 of your brothers and thrown into a well, now dragged out of the well, sold to these Ishmaelites. These people are going to take you off. Fast forward. Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. A man by the name of Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he prospered. And he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. By the way, I forgot to mention this. When he gets thrown into the cistern, he's 17 years old. The passage says that, but a passage that I skipped. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. So he left in Joseph's care everything he had. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with everything except for the food he ate. So in other words, the only thing he said, "I want a cheeseburger. I'm not talking to you, Joseph. I want a cheeseburger." Everything else, he let him take control of. Here's this kid, he's 17, he gets thrown into a well. He gets taken off by people, he gets sold, and he just starts prospering. And he says, run everything of my household. Now here comes the trouble. This is the downside of being well built and handsome, which is why I am the way I am. Now, Joseph was well built and handsome. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, "Come to bed with me." But he refused. "With me in charge," he told her, "my master did not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns has been entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How could I then do such a wicked thing and sin against my God?" And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her, even to be with her. One day, you always know when it starts like that, the trouble's coming. It always happens on that one day. If you wake up in the morning and it's that one day, don't get out of bed. Just stay in bed on the one day. One day he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, "Come to bed with me." But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out to the house, she called her household servants. "Look," she said to them, "this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us. He came in to sleep with me, but I screamed. When he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house." Liar! That's not what happened. But anyway, it doesn't matter. She kept his cloak beside her until his master came home. Then she told him the same story. "The Hebrew slave you brought came in to make sport of me. I screamed. He ran out. And here's his cloak." And Joseph goes to prison. Now, while he's in prison, something interesting happens. It says when he's in prison, when he's in prison, he's lifted up. He ends up being in charge. Here we are. Chapter 40. Sometime passes, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, the donut maker and the wine taster, offended their master, the king of Egypt. That's Pharaoh. Pharaoh was angry with his two officials, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard in the same prison where Joseph was confined. Now listen to this. The captain of the guard assigned them to Joseph. So even in prison, now Joseph's kind of rising. I mean, I don't know if he can rise too far in prison, but he's rising somewhat. And people are kind of putting him in charge of stuff. And he's in charge of these two people. After they've been in custody some time, each of the two men, the cupbearer and the baker, who were being held in prison, each had a dream on the same night, and each had a meaning of its own. And Joseph hears about it and says, I like dreams. Doesn't remember that this is what got him here in the first place, but that's okay. I like dreams. Tell me about your dream. And so they do. First goes the chief cupbearer. It says, so the chief cupbearer told Joseph his dream. He said, in my dream, I saw a vine in front of me, and on the vine were three branches. As soon as it budded, it blossomed, and the clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes, squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup, and put the cup in his hand. The cupbearer to the king was the one who gave him his wine, took a little sip of it first because if it was poisoned, out he goes. If it's not poisoned, the king can drink it. Joseph tells him what it means. He says, this is what it means. The three branches are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your position. And you'll be put Pharaoh's cup in his hand again, just as you used to do when you were his cupbearer. But when all goes well with you, remember me and show me kindness. Mention me to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison, for I was forcefully carried off in the land of the Hebrews, and even here I've done nothing to deserve being put in a dungeon. The baker is sitting there while this happens. This happens to the cupbearer. The baker's sitting there, and he is exactly like Sir Robin in the Holy Grail. If you remember when Lancelot comes up to the bridge, and he says, I just have three questions for you. And he says, what are the questions? What's your name, Sir Lancelot? What's your quest? Seek the Holy Grail. What is your favorite color? And he says, blue. And he goes, right off. Go ahead then. And he gets to go across the bridge. And Sir Robin, who's the chicken, says, that's easy. And he runs up there and he says, go on. What's your name? Yeah, Robin. What's your question? Yeah, we seek the Holy Grail. What is the capital of Assyria? What? I don't know. Boing, he goes off. Anyway, that's the same thing that's happening here. When the chief baker saw that Joseph had given a favorable interpretation, he said to Joseph, I had a dream. That's easy. On my head were three baskets of bread. In the top basket were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, but the birds were eating them out of the basket of my head. Joseph says, this is what it means. The three baskets are also 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat away your flesh. Oh, can I get a mulligan on that one? 3 days passes. It's Pharaoh's birthday. He gave a feast for all his officials. He lifted up the heads of the chief cupbearer and the chief baker in the presence of officials, restored the chief cupbearer to his position so that he once again put the cup into Pharaoh's hand, but he hanged the chief baker, just as Joseph had said to his in his interpretation. So it is a major high point for Joseph. It's like, I am 2 for 2 on the prophecy thing. And then this beautiful verse. The chief cupbearer, however, did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. I love the way the Bible's written, by the way. It just really grinds this one. It's like taking it and really taking the knife, sticks the knife in. The chief cupbearer didn't remember him. He forgot him. It just, twice, it's just to rub it in. Like, oh, dude, hello, I'm here in prison. I got you out. So, what happens then? 2 years pass. If you go to chapter 41, go a couple there. Chapter 41, 2 years passes. He's in prison. He's been wronged again. It's third time. He's been wronged again. And you can see this stuff's adding up inside of him. My brothers, Potiphar's wife, and now this cupbearer. 2 years passes. Pharaoh has a dream. He's standing by the Nile when out of the river came up 7 cows, sleek and fat, and they grazed among the reeds. After them, 7 other cows, ugly and gaunt, came out of the Nile and stood beside those on the riverbank. And the cows that were ugly and gaunt ate up the 7 sleek, fat cows. Then Pharaoh wakes up. He's going, whoa, what was that about? That was interesting. He happens to be talking to the cupbearer. And after 2 years, the cupbearer goes, dang, I forgot. There's this dude I met once somewhere while he was in prison. And he told me about a dream. Maybe he can interpret your dream. They bring up Joseph finally out of prison. He comes in. He interprets the dream. The dream is this. Pharaoh, there are going to be 7 very, very, very fat years. Your fields are going to produce more. Your cows are going to, everything. It's just going to be fat. But after those 7 years are going to come 7 years of extreme famine. Pharaoh is impressed with the dude. He says, you are my guy. And he says, the plan seemed good to Pharaoh and all his officials. So Pharaoh asked them, can we find anyone like this man, one in whom is the Spirit of God? Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning as wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all the people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you. So Pharaoh said to Joseph, I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh took a signet ring from his finger and put it on Joseph's finger. He dressed him in the robes of fine linen and put gold chain around his neck. Then he had him ride in a chariot as his second in command, and men shouted before him, make way. That's cool. Isn't that a neat thing? Make way. Get out of the way. Here comes an important dude. Get out of the way. Thus he put him in charge of the whole land of Egypt. That is awesome. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, I'm Pharaoh, but without your word, no one will lift a hand or a foot in all of Egypt. Pharaoh gave Joseph the name Zaphnath-Paneah. I guess that's a blessing to have that name. And gave him Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, to be his wife. He gets a wife out of the deal. And Joseph went throughout the land of Egypt. Joseph now is 30 years old. Quick math. Anyone? 13. Thank you. 13 years of downslide. And finally, 13 years from when he's thrown that cistern to now. He's got 13 years of sitting in different places and letting it brew inside of him what his brothers did to him. The story keeps going. Because the 7 years come and they store up stuff like crazy. And the famine starts to hit. And after just a couple years of the famine, everybody else in the land has nowhere to go to get grain. And guess who's got a lot of grain? Pharaoh. And all he's got, his granaries are filled. And so they sell it at a high premium. A.K.A. OPEC. You know what I'm talking about? They just raise the prices and they're making like off like a bandit. Jacob, his father, is still living. His father is far away from where this is, but he says in chapter 42 of Genesis, he says, why do you keep looking at each other? That's a great dad thing. That's a typical dad thing to say. What are you boys doing? Get off the video games. Get me some grain. He continues, I've heard that there's grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some food so that we may live and not die. So the brothers, not all of them, most of them go except for the youngest. The youngest now is a new one, named Benjamin. As they come, Joseph sees them. And he says, as soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. 13 years of bitterness and anger, and he's going to get even. Where do you come from, he said. From the land of Canaan, they replied, to buy food. Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. It's been 13 years. Then he remembered his dreams about them and said to them, you're spies. You've come to see where our land is unprotected. No, my lord, they answered. Your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. Your servants are honest men, not spies. No, he said to them, you've come to see where our land is unprotected. But they replied, your servants were 12 brothers, the son of one man, who lives in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with their father, and one is no more. Ouch. That one would hurt. Joseph said to them, it is just as I told you. You are spies, and this is how you'll be tested. As surely as Pharaoh lives, you will not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. You're not telling me the truth. He's testing them. So he says, here's the deal. You are going to leave. One of your brothers are going to stay here and he'll put you in prison. And then you guys can go. And then you bring back the youngest one and then we'll talk some more. But until then, he stays in prison. They agree to that. They go back to their father. Pick it up in verse 36. Their father, Jacob, said to them, you have deprived me of my children. Joseph is no more, and now Simeon, he's the one that's in prison. Simeon is no more. And now you want to take Benjamin. Everything is against me. Then Reuben said to his father, you may put both of my sons to death if I do not bring him back to you. That sounds like a nice grandfather thing to do. You know, like, this is definitely the Simpsons, all right? These are unhealthy people. Okay, entrust him to my care and I will bring him back. But Jacob said, my son will not go down there with you. The brother is dead and he's the only one left. If harm comes to him on the journey you are taking, you will bring my gray hair down to the grave in sorrow. However, very shortly, they eat all the grain that they originally got the first time because Joseph gave them some grain and they need more. Famine was still severe in the land, chapter 43. So they'd eaten all the grain and the father says, go back, get more grain. They tell him, we can't go unless we have Benjamin. He told us we have to take the youngest one with us. And so he agrees to it. He lets the youngest one go. Now, and here's where we pick it up. They're going on the way. So the men took the gifts and doubled the amount of silver and Benjamin also. They hurried to Egypt and presented themselves to Joseph. When Joseph saw Benjamin with him, he said to the steward of the house, take these men into my house, slaughter an animal, prepare for dinner. They're to eat with me at noon. Joseph came home. They presented him the gifts they had brought into the house. They bowed down before him to the ground. He asked them how they were and they said, how is your aged father you told me about? Is he still living? This is Joseph's question. They replied, your servant, our father, is still alive and well. And they bowed low to pay him honor. As he looked about and saw his brother Benjamin, his own mother's son, he asked, is this your youngest brother, the one you told me about? And he said, God be gracious to you, my son. Deeply moved at the sight of his brother, Joseph hurried out and looked for a place to weep. He went to his private room and wept there. Now put yourself in the mind of Joseph. All this trauma, and now he sees Benjamin, his youngest brother, he's never seen, and something clicks inside of him. He starts to weep. After he'd washed his face, he came out controlling himself, said, serve the food. They served him by himself, the brothers by themselves, and the Egyptians with them by themselves, because Egyptians could not with the Hebrews, for that is detestable to Egyptians. The men had been seated before him in the order of their ages, from firstborn to youngest, and they looked at each other in astonishment. When the portions were served from the Joseph's table, Benjamin's portion was five times as much as anyone else's. So they feasted and drank freely with him. Now, they want to go home. Joseph is planning what looks like his revenge. Joseph gave these instructions to the steward of his house. Fill the men's sacks with as much food as they can carry, and put each man's silver in the mouth of his sack. Then, put my cup, the silver one, into the mouth of the youngest one's sack, along with the silver for his grain. As he did as Joseph said, and they did as Joseph said. As morning dawned, the men were sent on their way with their donkeys. They had not gone far from the city when Joseph said to his steward, go after these men at once. And when you catch up with them, say to them, why have you repaid good with evil? Isn't this cup my master drinks from? Isn't this the cup my master drinks from and also used for divination? This is a wicked thing you have done. When he caught up with them, he repeated these words to them. But they said to him, why does my Lord say such things? Far be it from your servants to do anything like that. We even brought back to you from the land of Canaan the silver we found inside the mouths of our sacks the first time. So why would we steal silver or gold from your master's house? If any of our servants is found to have it, he will die. And the rest of us will become my Lord's slaves. Very well. Then he said, let it be as you say. Whoever is found to have it will become my slave. The rest of you will be free from blame. Each of them quickly lowered his sack to the ground, opened it. Then the steward presented a search, beginning with the oldest and ending with the youngest. And the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. And the brothers are freaking out. Joseph has got them exactly where he wants them. Completely ready. Now they're in trouble because the one, Reuben, said, you can kill my kids. He's got them exactly where he wants them. And look what happens. He's set up for his revenge, right? No. That's not what happens. Then Joseph could control himself no longer. Before all his attendants, he cried out, make everyone leave my presence. So there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him and Pharaoh's household heard about it. Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still living? But his brothers were not able to answer because they were terrified at his presence. So Joseph said to his brothers, come close to me. When they had done so, he said, I'm your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. Wow. For 2 years now, there has been famine in the land. And for the next 5 years, there will not be plowing or reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then, it is not you who sent me here, but God. He made me a father to Pharaoh, lord of his entire household and ruler of all Egypt. Wow. Now, there's a lot of things you can get from this account. But one thing I take from it is God was making a man of peace. He went through all of those things over years and years and years and years. Up, top of his game, crashing down over and over and over. And you'd think all those things would be stored up within him saying, I'm gonna give it to those guys, every one of them. Minus Benjamin, I'm going to give it to the rest of them. And he doesn't. And he doesn't. Where does he get? You can kind of picture it there, but you really picture it in the last part of the book of Genesis. In chapter 50, Jacob, his father, now has died. And his sons are frightened that Joseph will be angry with them. If you read it, it says, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, what if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him? So they sent word to Joseph saying, your father left these instructions before he died. This is what you are to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of the servants of the God of your father. When their message came to him, Joseph wept. His brothers then came and threw themselves down before him. We are your slaves, they said. But Joseph said to them, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children. And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. Wow. How do you do that? What was it ultimately in all those years that Joseph, when you think he's thinking about bitterness and anger, what is he actually meditating on in prison, when he's being shafted by the cupbearer, when all these different things are happening, what's he meditating on? The sovereignty of God. That God is in control of this. And I don't get it, but you do, God. How do you become a person of peace? You become a person of peace by not looking at all the circumstances that you darn right you got a reason to be angry for. Would you do it by becoming a person who looks at God and saying, God, you're the one in control. This Christmas time, as you think of when Christ came to earth and gave you himself, died on the cross, took your sins upon himself. The great exchange happens. You take his righteousness. He takes your sins. As that, you meditate on that. Then you're able to look at other people and say, you know what? I release you. I release you. I'm not going to be a person of justice in the sense that I must get mine. The Apostle Paul wrote this as he was writing about in the book of Romans when he goes through the great gospel message of what Christ did for you. He says, therefore, since we have been justified with faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. The way you become a peacemaker first and foremost is you take your life circumstances and your sins and your failures and all that, wrap it up, and you make peace with God. If you don't have peace with God, you will never have peace with other people. And you will never have peace with yourself. Stan was telling me about Brian Welch, right, the guitarist for Korn, and how, if you read his biography, which I'm going to hold you to now to let me read that, but how his whole encounter, as he was this lead singer, gobs of money and all these different things, he was seeking after peace and could never find it until he came to Christ. When he came to Christ, he finally found what he was looking for. The third candle of the Advent season is peace. And real peace only comes from when you trust in an almighty, sovereign God. Let me ask you a simple question this morning as we close. Have you made peace with God? Do you make peace with God on a regular basis? Let's pray together. Jesus, I love that you are the Prince of Peace, as it says in Isaiah 9:6, that you are the one that came. And we think of this season, we think of peace on earth and goodwill towards men. And Father, I pray for that. I pray for that in our hearts, God, that you'd fill us with your peace, the kind of peace that is steadfast, the kind of peace that lasts, the kind of peace that is not based on our material possessions or even how our relationships are going. When I think of that kind of peace, I think of a dove asleep on a cliff when there's a major storm happening, but feeling safe by this shelter that's there for them in the midst of the storm. Because I think of the life of Joseph and I think of the storms in his life that could have easily had hardened his heart and made him a bitter, bitter man. Lord, I pray that you would not allow us to take those turns, those little small trajectories toward holding and harboring and wanting to be a person that wants to get their revenge. That you would make us people of peace because you are the God of peace. So I pray for that. I pray for people in this room who've maybe never in their lives have come to a point where they've allowed you to be their sin bearer. Allowed to say, Jesus, I want to have peace with God. I've been running after everything else. I want peace with you. And I pray it this morning, God, that you'd speak to their hearts in words that go way beyond my words. And by your Holy Spirit, you'd let them know. You'd woo them to yourself as a loving Father. And you'd show them that you care for them so much. You want them to come back to you. And I pray you'd give them the courage to say, yes, Jesus, I trust you. I let it all go. Lord, I pray for people in this room who maybe have been around family or other relationships, maybe even the last few days. And inside of them, the bitterness is just eking them alive. God, I pray by your Spirit, miraculously, that they would lay that down, even as I'm speaking right now. They will give it to you. You intended it for harm, but God intended it for good. And God, would we have that kind of trust in you? We pray all these things in Jesus' name.